presents a material to you that you may find slightly more mathematical than the material taught during the previous week. So the first lecture will be devoted to path integral formulation of many body problems. This material may be found by you somewhat similar to what you're learning now in QFT2, or probably somewhat different in some sense. But if you saw this material before, and you will recognize something that has overlap with what you study during QFT2 course, this will be very good. For example, this concerns the integration over fermion fields. So if you find something in this course that will help you with QFT2, then I think that I'm doing a good job. So I will cover basically four topics. I will briefly tell you why path integrals are useful in condensed matter. Then I will talk about the concept of coherent states applied to bosons, to boson operators. Then I will talk about Grassmann variables. And as an example, tell you how to do Gaussian integration over those Grassmann variables. Okay, let's start. You know already, based on quantum theory course, that there are two approaches to quantum mechanics. First approach is the formalism of canonically quantized field operators. So this is what you basically studied in QFT1 course. And the second approach is functional integration. So why nowadays functional integration is becoming more and more popular in condensed matter? The first reason is that in the formalism of functional integration, it is easier to see classical limit. This is especially important when you deal with systems of bosons that try to condense themselves into ground state, into the state with lowest energy. When bosons condense, they can be treated essentially as some kind of a classical system. So those problems are better treated using path integrals. So then the other reason is that it looks that nowadays, non-perturbative approaches can be better formulated in path integral formalism. So it is easier to some diagrams to do auxiliary transformation that will allow you to single out the necessary collective excitations, collective variables. And the third reason is that that using this formalism, it is easier to develop the new concepts, such as topology, geometry. For example, you saw how nicely in the path integral formulation for the long wavelength excitations of magnets, you could derive the spectrum. You derive the Berry phase that can be, strictly speaking, derived only using path integral formulation via coherent states for spin operators. And you could deduce the excitation spectrum. So let me just briefly summarize this. Why path integrals? In condensed matter. So efficient formulation. Of non-perturbative methods. Then classical limit. Is more visible or accessible. So you quite often try to find saddle point solutions, and this is where a classical limit is seen. And second, actually third, new concepts are easily developed. or I better say easily studied. Just for example, topology, topological excitations. So I believe that Alec will tell you something during the third week. Good. So, but to formulate path integrals, what do we need? We need pretty much the same things as we need in ordinary quantum mechanics. So what did we do in ordinary quantum mechanics when we tried to construct the path integral for quantum mechanical, for the propagator of quantum mechanical particles? We partitioned the time slice in many steps that are infinitesimally small, then introduced the resolution of identities containing coherent states. So when you have just one particle, these states are eigenstates of coordinate and momentum operators. And then did some manipulations that allowed us to switch from operators to field, and then took the limit n going to infinity, where n is the number of steps. So here we have pretty much the same. Albeit many body Hamiltonians are formulated very often in terms of quantum mechanical creation and annihilation operators. So we need then the eigenstates of those operators. That's why our next topic is coherent states for bosons. Coherent states for bosons. What I will be talking about is mainly a pure math. So suppose we have creation and annihilation operators, AI, AI dagger, right? So we have the full set of them. Suppose we have the Fock space, the complete set of states, and AI dagger act in this space. They are bosonic. And satisfy canonical commutation relations. AI, comma, AJ dagger equal to delta IJ, right? So our question is, can we find eigenstates of these operators? AI dagger. So this is the question. Well, if we have the complete set of states, then any state that we wish to be the eigenstates of these two operators can be represented as follows. Any state phi, I will denote this one. This way it can be just represented in this form. It is some kind of the linear combination of n1, n2, the linear combination of all possible states in Fock space, n1, n2, and so forth, where these states contain arbitrary number of particles. So they can be written as follows. A1 dagger in power n1 divided by n1 factorial, A2 dagger in power n2 divided by n2 factorials, so forth, acting on complete vacuum. So the vacuum is the state that contains no particles at all. So, this expression is very general and represents any state. So we expect that eigenstate of these operators is going to have this form. But now we can ask a question. Can AI dagger have an eigenstate? of this form? The answer is no. Why? Because acting by creation operator will necessarily increase the number of particles by one. By one, so it cannot be any eigenstate. No, no, AI dagger cannot have eigenstate in this form. It's completely prohibited. Nevertheless, AI can have. Can have. And let me write down the definition of the state that will be a coherent state for bosonic operator. Okay, actually I have, I'm not very good at using this space at the board. So, but, okay, let me write it here. So let's define the state phi in the following form. Exponent in the following power. Sum over some very complex variables phi I, then AI acting on complete vacuum. So phi I is the set, is a set of complex numbers, all complex numbers. Or better to say, not all, but better to say some complex numbers. Or simply is complex numbers, is a set of complex numbers. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, thank you. Yes, it is a dagger, yes. This is the set of complex numbers. So as an exercise, you can check, and this will be a problem during your tomorrow's tutorial, not today's, that acting with AI on phi equal to phi I times state phi. This is the basic property. So AI acts irreducibly in the space of these states, meaning that whenever you apply AI to phi, you will get on the right phi I. So these are phis are coherent states for bosons. And they are characterized by this set of complex variables. Now one can construct the adjoint set of states. So as you can see, this is the cat state, and one can construct brass states labeled this way that are defined as, so bra vacuum, exponent, and here's some over fi bar, sorry, phi I bar ai, where phi I bar are complex conjugates of phi I. Good, and one can check the following property. Property two. That if we have bra phi and operator AI dagger acts on the left, then we just have the following bra phi, phi I bar. So sometimes you can of course see the notations that the complex conjugates of phi I are simply labeled by the star. But it is more convenient for us to label them by bar. And soon you will learn why. Very good. Any questions at that point? Good. So there is another properties. I am not giving the proof because tomorrow you will play with those states and prove all these properties. Another property. So if we have two states, two coherent states, say theta and phi, then their overlap, phi bra ket, sorry, theta bra phi ket, equal to exponent over I, phi I, theta I, sorry, phi I. So theta is characterized by the set of complex numbers here bar. By the set of complex numbers theta I, and phi is characterized by the set of complex numbers phi I. So if we construct this overlap, we will get exponent of this expression. And as a result, we can write that phi bra phi ket equal to exponent of the sum over I, and we can write there the absolute values, the amplitudes of complex variables phi I squared. So very good. This is what you're going to prove during tomorrow's tutorial, and the starting point is just the definition. Finally, the most important property, the most important property, this is property one, two, three, property number four. The fact is that these coherent states form a complete set of states. Namely, one can prove that if we integrate over all complex variables phi I bar and phi I in this way, so this is the product of differentials, and have as a weight exponent in power minus sum over I phi I absolute value squared, and have here first ket, then bra. So that this acts as an operator, we are going to have the unity in the right-hand side. So this very important condition is the condition of completeness. The condition of completeness. So in fact, the set of coherent states is an overcomplete set of states. Why overcomplete? Overcomplete because of this, exponent. So this overlap is not equal to one. So these states are not orthogonal to each other. That's why we have to have this exponent here to ensure that the right-hand side is equal to one. So the proof follows so-called Schur's lemma, but you can prove this directly by simply doing Gaussian integration, just simply by doing Gaussian integration and expanding these two states via the eigenstates of harmonic oscillator, basically via the eigenstates of harmonic oscillator. So this is what you will do during tomorrow's tutorial. But in the textbooks, this identity is proved using Schur's lemma. Schur's lemma states that if we have the set of operators, so AI and AI bra in our case, and they act irreducibly in the space, in the Fock space. And they do act irreducibly, because when you use AI and act on phi, you will get phi I in the right hand side. And if they commute, all of them commute with this operator, then this operator must be necessarily proportional to one, and one has to care just about renormalization constant. But this is just a more formal way to prove this. You can prove this resolution of identity just knowing that the set of eigenstates for harmonic oscillators simply forms the complete set of states. Good, very good. So let me just conclude this by saying that quite often people use more compact way to label this product. So they write, just this is a notation, that product of I d phi I bar d phi I divided by pi. So this whole product is simply labeled as this d phi bar comma phi. So very good. Any questions? Sorry.
Is there a subscript I on the space?
Where?
Here.
Yeah, phi. Phi I.
No.
What
the states? Yes, you put vector.
Yeah, the phi I of the coefficient.
Here.
It's in the box inside the bra.
It's in the bracket.
Bra. This is kit. This is bra. Yeah. No. No, here no, no. Here no, because you have exponent over sum of all possible phi I. No, no. Here you don't have subscript, because we have defined the coherent state here, and it involves all variables from the set of complex numbers. So you imagine that there are many variables. Of course, you can limit yourself with several variables, with one variable. So it doesn't matter. But even if we have infinite set of some numbers, then we can still use and prove this condition. Okay, excellent. Excellent. We're done with coherent states for bosons, because it's probably a better idea to have some practice using them by checking these properties. And this is what you're going to do during tomorrow's tutorial. Tomorrow's tutorial, I left everything without proof now. Yeah. So tomorrow, I hope that much more will be clearer. Okay, now let's go to the next topic, Grassmann variables. I would like to ask you, how many of you saw Grassmann variables before? Please raise your hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Quite many of you. So, okay, and how many of you never saw them before? In QFT1, but anyway, so were you told about this in QFT1? If you saw this in QFT1, then that's very, very good. It won't hurt to see them once again. Did you see coherent states with involving Grassmann variables? No. So that's why it's a good idea to recap this material once again. Good, so I will try to be quite brief as well here. And let me just go to this board. So Grassmann variables. So these are the sets of anti-commuting variables. So let's denote them by eta I. And we have the following property of these variables. We can have one variable, we can have many variables. So eta I, eta j plus eta j eta I equal to zero. Basically, we have to have some kind of a convention relating to the order in which we are going to position our Grassmann variables. So if we interchange them, then their resulting structure simply changes sign. It changes sign. So clearly, eta I squared equal to zero. So we cannot have non-zero eta squared, eta cubed, and so forth. So as a result, if we consider a function of Grassmann variable, say f of eta, we can just Taylor expand it. And when we Taylor expand this, we have only two terms. F of zero plus d over d eta of f times eta itself. Yeah, times eta itself. So if f is a scalar function, then f of zero is just a scalar, it's a regular non-Grassmann variable, then we have to assume that d over d eta is the Grassmann variable itself. So if we have more than one variable, for example, two Grassmann variables, then we can also define a non-Grassmann function of, say, eta 1, eta 2, and write down its expansion, f of 0, comma 0 plus df over d eta 1. So taken at the point where all eta, both eta 1 and eta 2 equal to 0, times eta 1 plus the same expression involving eta 2 plus the second derivative. That's all. The Taylor series has to stop at the second order. So one can easily write down the generalization for the function that involves 3, 4, 5 Grassmann variables. So since the derivatives, this object d over d eta I is a Grassmann variable itself, then they must also obey anti-commutation relations, right? So if this is anti-commutator, and we denote it using curly brackets, anti-commutator, then we have the properties that the anti-commutator of the derivatives, d over d eta I, comma d over d eta j, is equal to zero. And another property that the anti-commutator of d over eta I, comma eta j, anti-commutator equal to delta I j. So these properties are very useful in dealing with Grassmann variables. Good. So we see how differentiation is defined. D over d eta, also Grassmann variable. Now we can define integrations. So integration over Grassmann variables is defined as an operation that is identical to differentiation. So this is strange, but this is true. So this operation, the operation of integration, is defined purely artificially. It's just a definition, because we cannot ascribe any real numbers to Grassmann variables. We cannot view them as variables that assume some number, say either 0 or 1. All we know is their algebra, their anti-commutative algebra. So that's why if we want to use some operations that we normally use with respect to real ordinary variables, we have to define integration artificially. Namely, we define the following integral, d eta f of eta equal to df over d eta. Well, this is how it is defined. So I don't see any advantage here, and I don't see any disadvantage.
Why don't we just keep writing down everything in terms of differentiation?
So no, it doesn't look better. I can say that integration looks better than differentiation, but it's better to define integration because I would say, as you will see soon, the path integrals are the integrals, path integrals, not path derivatives. So we use the word integration when we consider path integrals. So it's better to define integration over Grassmann variables. So we could easily start with the integration without considering the derivative. So why not then? So if we substitute this Taylor expansion, and we will immediately see that as a consequence, we have two important identities. That integral over differential over Grassmann variables is equal to 0, but d eta is equal to 1. Sorry, 1. Very, very good. So differential is also formally a Grassmann variable, and the convention is that this is one only if d eta precedes eta itself. It stands before. So the order of in which Grassmann variables are positioned under the sign of integral matters a lot. So for, yeah.
So integral f of eta d eta would be minus?
Yeah, minus, yeah, if you just write in the other order, then you automatically have minus sign, yeah.
I think the Grassmann variables can also be understood as one. So I think about this whole stuff in terms of geometry, and then an expansion of f of eta is f of 0 plus a derivative, that just means that this is how you can expand a vector or one form. So I mean, if you think about it like this, I think it becomes maybe a little bit.
Well, I didn't think about it. I didn't think so about this, but I will think. But I don't think anyway. So I will continue just to get the taste. Of course tend to think that mathematicians tend to think about Grassmann algebra in their own way, but physicists, I believe, think in a slightly more simplified and more formal way. Okay. So just to generalize this formula for the case of many variables, we will adopt the notation that if we have many Grassmann variables, then we write d eta 1, d eta 2, multi dots, d eta n, then eta n, multi dots, eta 2, eta 1, are equal to 1. Very, very good. So, yeah.
An integral is something which is highly non-local, whereas a derivative is something local. Where are you taking that integral over? Whole space or?
over whole space. Well, this, so I have just one sign of integral. We integrate over the whole, here, over the whole set of Grassmann variables. So I can't interpret this as being local or non-local somehow. This is just a convention. A convention, well, the rationale behind this convention is quite clear. let's look at this definition. So we have this pair. And first, we have the eta, then eta. So pairs of Grassmann variables, this is a nice feature. They always commute with each other, or they always commute. So single Grassmann variables always anti-commute. But pairs commute with pairs. So we can take this pair, the eta n, and essentially consider this as non-Grassmann object. Then we have d eta 2, then we have next to it here d eta n minus 1, and here n minus 1. We anti-commute d eta n minus 1 through this, basically drag it through these two variables and put it next to eta n minus 1. And this will again give us a pair of Grassmann variables. And so forth. Applying then this definition, we will see that this must be necessarily equal to 1.
When we write down the integral, like is the leftmost measure acting on the system first, or rightmost measure acting on the system first? I mean, like if I try to interpret those integral in terms of differentiation, like can you write down explicitly in terms of differential?
Okay, in terms of differential. So if we consider differentiation, strictly speaking, people differ the left derivative that acts on the left and the derivative that acts on the right. We will assume that everything acts on the left. So if we have the operator d over d eta, then and if we have say two Grassmann variables, say theta and eta, then in order to get the result, we must first put eta to next to differential operator, and then assume that this is one. And the same is with the integration. First drag next to either d over d eta, and here, say in case of eta 1, we have to drag 1, 2, 3, and so forth, and determine the sign, and only after that we can assume that this is 1. So I hope this helps.
On eta 1 first or eta n first? Eta 1 first?
Let me give you just an example. An example so that you could get the taste. Example. D eta 1, D eta 2, eta 2, eta 1 is equal to 1. What do we do? We drag this eta 1 through eta 2, d eta 2, and put it here. This gives overall plus sign. So we have d eta 1, eta 1, then another such integral. I simply use one integral here, one sign of integral, but of course I can equally use many signs of integral. So d eta 1, we drag it through, drag it to the left so that eta 1 could stand right to the right of d eta 1. And we have here d eta 2, eta 2. So this is 1 and this is 1. So overall it is equal to 1. But well, they're the same as with differentiation. So, but from the other side, if I write things in this form, d eta 1, d eta 2, here eta 1, eta 2, what is it going to be equal to? Minus one, because we drag this eta 1 to the left and put it right next to d eta 1. We made one permutation. This gives 1 minus 1, so this is minus 1. Good, good. So we should not be afraid of doing, of performing some linear combinations over the space of given Grassmann variables. So if we have the set of Grassmann variables eta I, then we can form the linear combinations using ordinary numbers. So, and those will be also Grassmann variables. So for example, linear combinations. So for example, for eta 1 comma eta 2, we can form the linear combinations. Eta equal to eta 1 plus eta 2 divided by square root of 2. And let's write eta star equal to eta 1 minus eta 2. Oh, sorry, let me put I here. I here. No, nothing prohibits us from multiplication Grassmann variables by ordinary complex numbers. So, and eta star equal to minus I eta 2 divided by square root of 2. An interesting thing here is that we have constructed two linear combinations and labeled them as eta and eta star. And they look like complex conjugate to each other, right? Based on the notation. But they are not complex conjugate. Even written this way, they should not be interpreted as complex conjugate because they are not ordinary numbers. So in fact, eta and eta star, or for example, you can label it with eta bar, it doesn't matter. They are two independent Grassmann variables, new Grassmann variables, even if they look as complex conjugate to each other. And one can check that this transformation is unitary. And it preserves the measure of integration. D eta star equal to minus I, d eta 1, d eta 2. So apart from the prefactor minus I, the measure is preserved. So you can integrate over at using differentials d eta 1, d eta 2, and with equal success, you can integrate using d eta and d eta star. So once again, when we formulate the coherent states for fermions, we will use two different sets of Grassmann variables that may seem that may look as complex conjugate if compared to the coherent states for bosons. So let's now consider somewhat more complicated integral that will bring us one step closer to the form in which Grassmann variables enter a real path integrals. So let's consider the following integral. Consider the integral d eta, d, but it's a d eta bar, d eta, where d eta bar and d eta are completely independent differentials that are themselves Grassmann variables of the following construction, e in power eta bar a eta. So what is this integral equal to? Of course, what is important is the order in which eta bar and eta stand, and Also, it is important that eta bar and eta enter in this order under the sign, under the exponent. Yeah. Oh, of course, very, very good. This is what I wanted to ask you. A is a real number or complex number? A, just a complex number. Because if you have just an ordinary function, exponents, polynomial, whatever, then its argument must be non-Grassmann variables. And eta bar times eta is perceived as non-Grassmann variable. So the only possibility that we have is that eta is a non-Grassmann and ordinary number, just a complex number. So what to do? We do a simple thing. In fact, because of those constraints that you have to truncate the Taylor series up to only certain order, and things beyond this truncation automatically gives zero, allows us to do a very simple manipulation. We expand exponent this way, 1 minus eta bar a eta. Can we have more terms here? The answer is no, we can't, because eta bar squared, eta squared, they automatically give us zero. So d eta bar d eta, what are we going to have from this term, 1? Zero. According to this definition. So we have minus d eta bar d eta, eta bar a eta. So, and using this definition, or even the definition I wrote there, we anti-commute this differential with eta bar and get that it is equal to a. So, let me make also the following note. And when we deal with path integration, you may recall this note. So if we consider the integral d eta bar d eta, and have here eta bar e in power minus eta bar a eta, then we can also expand this exponent. But in this case, only the first term of expansion will contribute. So this will give us just the eta bar, the eta bar equal to 1. And one can write it this way, 1 over a times a. So just make a note of this, you will see why this result is important and interesting when we will define Green's function in the path integral formalism. Once again, when you do manipulations with Grassmann variables, then it is a good idea to keep track of signs everywhere. So let's look at our Gaussian integral and make a simple generalization. Let's make some generalization before we go to something more complicated. So let's consider this integral I equal to the product of I d eta I bar d eta I. Once again, all barred Grassmann variables are completely independent of non-barred. So, and put exponent here, minus eta I bar lambda I eta I. And again, lambda I, complex numbers. So what we are going to do? We note that the bilinears of eta I bar eta I commute with each other, right? So Peary pairs commute, right?
Are you summing over I?
Yep. Yes, I'm summing over I. Yeah. 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 Exactly. Yeah. So we can just write. So we have integration measure d eta I by d eta I. And because pairs of Grassmann variables commute, we can just write this as a product of the exponents that involve each pair. So e in power eta I bar lambda I eta I. So, and remembering the Gaussian integral we have above, we can write this as the product of lambda I. Okay, any questions at this point? Because now I will go to the main computation of today's lecture, in fact. So if there are no questions, let's consider the following. Let's consider our last topic, Gaussian integration. Integration over Grassmann variables. So if you have any questions, so don't hesitate to ask. So let's consider the following integral J of A, and A is denoted with by having two arrows, well, with a double arrow line. A of B, B is a vector. Then B star of this form, product I equal to 1 to n. Yeah, and here we limit ourselves with specific number n, actually 2 n Grassmann variables. I product of I between 1 and n, d eta I bar, d eta I. So this is the measure and exponent minus eta I bar a I j eta j plus b I star eta I plus b I eta I bar. So what is what here? So Aij is a Hermitian matrix. So eta I and eta I bar, they're actually, sorry, I have here no bar. Otherwise, it is correct. So eta I and eta I bar form the set of 2n independent Grassmann variables. They are all independent. And B with the vector sign, and B vector star are two sets of, again, independent also Grassmann variables. Well, we if we assume that eta I and eta I bar are Grassmann variables, then we have to assume that B I star and B I are Grassmann variables as well. Well, but they are just some Grassmann variables, and we are not integrating over them. Yes. From now on, we assume the summation over repeated indices. Otherwise, the algebra will be too lengthy. Yeah.
The point is that this is anti-symmetric, right?
Right.
So why don't we just demand that AIJ is an anti-symmetric matrix? I mean, it's our mission, then I can imagine that lots of stuff
gets
killed in the matrix.
Actually, you.
Because the real anti-symmetric part of it is just gone automatically, right?
But let's assume that at this point, let's assume it is Hermitian, because it is easier to view the linear transformations we're going to perform. We can just assume, of course, that is anti-symmetric subsequently, but let's for now assume it to be Hermitian. So what are we going to do next? So we want this integral to look like the integral we had above that involved the product of lambda I. So we do the linear transformation. So to proceed, we make the linear transformation. The linear transformations, better to say, that eta I goes to eta I minus aij minus 1, where these elements are the elements of inverse matrix, bj, then eta I bar going to eta I bar plus a j I minus 1 b j. Why here we have minus and here we have plus, you will see just in a minute when we write down the expression that we have under exponent after plugging those transformation. So after making this linear transformation, we are going to see that minus eta I a I j eta j plus b I star eta I plus b I eta I goes to the following. Well, we just simply plug. Yeah, equally questions? Yeah.
Is there a star in any of these
b's? Right. Right, the star is here. Very, very good. Yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah. One second. No. So sorry. Star is here. Yeah. By here. Right. Exactly. So when we substitute, right here. Here, of course. So why here minus, here plus, we will see shortly. Well, sometimes, of course, you can write this expression, say, with eta bar and bi interchange somehow, but I decided to write this way. So we have here Okay, это I plus A KI minus 1 BK star AIJ. Это J minus A J L minus 1 BL. So we sum over all repeated indices, so we don't write the sums to save time and space. Sorry, I forget plus B I star eta I minus A I J minus 1 B J plus B I eta I bar plus A J I minus 1 B J star. Right? And this is equal to, I don't like long chalks. It's quite difficult to manipulate with those. Equal to the following minus eta I bar A I J eta J. Right? This is simple. It comes from the first terms in these two brackets. Plus. Now we use the property that matrix, the property of inverse matrices. Namely, we use that A, say K I minus 1 times A I J equal to delta K J. So we will have from this plus eta I bar B I minus B K star eta K plus B K star A K L minus 1 B L plus B I star eta I plus B I eta I bar minus B I star eta I J minus 1 B J minus B J star A J I minus 1 B I. So if we look at the term, then we see that this term cancels with this term. When we anti-commute, we will get extra minus sign here, and this term cancels with this term. Then this term cancels with this term, and we have just the following: minus eta I bar A I J eta J minus B I star eta, sorry, A I J minus 1 B J. So what we did, we diagonalized what stands under exponent using those linear transformations. So we performed the linear transformations and obtained something more pleasant under the sign of exponents. So what to do next? Next, we will do the following. So matrix Aij is arbitrary. We assume that it is Hermitian. It is not necessarily so anti-symmetric. It is just a Hermitian matrix. And Hermitian matrix love unitary transformations that leave the measure intact. So let's assume that our matrix is diagonalizable. Assume that there is some unitary transformation. There is some unitary matrix. Unitary matrix Uij such that if we act on this, well, again, we imply the summation over repeated indices UKLALM UMN minus 1 equal to lambda K when K is equal to N and 0 otherwise. Matrix U is unitary, and we can always find such a matrix for Hermitian matrix. Always. This is the theorem from linear algebra. And we make use of this theorem here. So this will mean the following, that if we look at this bilinear, then we write eta I bar a I j eta j equal to, let's write this as follows, eta I bar delta I l a l m delta m g eta j. We just simply rewrote this bilinear in this form by introducing some delta functions in between. And right, represent those delta functions as the products of elements from unitary matrix. So Ai bar Ui k minus 1 UKL ALM UMN power minus 1 UNJ eta J. So this is KL. So this is nothing else than delta IL, and this is nothing else like delta MJ. But what's this? This is the linear transformation performed on our original Grassmann variables. And let's call this transformation as eta K bar with some prime. It's also the new Grassmann variable. This is, according to what we wrote before, is lambda K delta MN. And this is our new Grassmann variable eta n prime. So this is equal to sum over k. Well, here I use the signed sum because there are three letters that have the same index k. Eta k bar prime lambda k eta. So if we look at our integral, then we see that this is a constant that can be taken out of the sign of integral, and this now becomes a diagonal form. So what are we left with? What should we take? Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's like the standard trick when you have a Gaussian integral, right?
Right.
It's kind of weird, right? Because we integrate over some kind of Grassmann domain, which we picture to be infinite, even if we don't really know what it is. Right?
Well, it is weird, but this is what people use. So compared to what to this ordinary trick, when we have Gaussian integration over complex variables or real variables, we have to be extra careful about the order. This is the only unpleasant thing. So yeah, exactly. So what are we left with? Can anyone tell me? There is one last thing we should take care of about. So we have to convince ourselves that the measure of integration, this product, is invariant. Is invariant. So let me just probably since there are not many. Anyway, let me just spend some time, since we have still 5-10 minutes. So let's consider the, let me take this blue chalk. Measure. Right. Let's consider this. Product from 1 to n of I prime. So, and show that it is equal to our to the product of our original Grassmann variables times the determinant of unitary matrix. And the determinant of unitary matrix, or its absolute value, is 1. So this will prove that our measure will remain intact. So let me do the following. Let me write this product of anti-commuting variables in the following form: 1 over n factorial epsilon I j multi dots l d eta I prime d eta j prime multi dots d eta l prime. So this is absolutely anti-symmetric tensor in n dimensions. So we can always do this because we can always permute these variables in such a form that the sign will correspond to the sign of this anti-symmetric tensor. Because there are n factorial permutations, then this looks just an identity. Why did we write in this form? Because we can further write 1 over n factorial epsilon I j multi dots l and apply unitary transformation by writing this differential in terms of original Grassmann variables. So u I prime eta, sorry, d eta I, then multi dots u l prime d eta l prime. So, and here we have 1 over n factorial epsilon I j multi dots l u I prime multi dots u l prime. And well, you use the elements of unitary matrices that are all ordinary numbers, and keep take care about the products of di I prime di prime and so forth d eta l prime. We can again write this. So this in the form of that we just see. So 1 over n factorial product Right. So we can write 1 over n factorial epsilon I prime so forth L prime and the product from, let's call it this way, from 1 to n and our original differentials d eta a. So, but what's this? This is nothing else than if you check the textbooks on linear algebra, this is the determinant of U. So analogously, we can show that the product of the differentials d eta I bar prime is equal to the determinant of u minus 1 product I equal to 1 to n d eta I bars. Good. So this just means that product of d eta I bar prime d eta I prime equal to the product d eta I bar d eta I. Right. And after that, we just look at this result and look at what we have here and write down our final answer that J as a function of elements of Hermitian matrix, then vectors of Grassmann variables B star and B is equal to minus exponent, so minus bi star a I j minus 1 bj times integral of product e minus 1 d eta I prime d eta I bar prime d eta I prime. So this is our measure, exponent of minus, here we have sum over I lambda I eta I prime bar eta I equal to exponent minus b I star a I j minus 1 b j. And what's this? What is the, we must have here product times product of all lambda i's, but what is the product? Yeah, absolutely right. Determinant of this matrix. So this is our main result. Yeah. So the main result of today's lecture that will be extremely useful for the future. Why is this result, let me give you a couple of last comments, why is this result so interesting? And it is interesting because contrary to the ordinary Gaussian integration that involves ordinary real or complex numbers, determinant appears where? Yeah, in the numerator, not in denominator, but in the numerator. So you will see that this plays a very big role when we consider path integrals for bosons and fermions. Moreover, it plays enormous role somewhere else when people consider supersymmetric actions for disordered systems. So if you're interested in those theories, you can write separately. But the key thing is that in the theories of supersymmetry, that you use these remarkable properties, that determinant of functions for fermions appears in the numerator, but determinants of functions, bosons, appears in the denominator. And they cancel each other. But this is just last comment to motivate you. Okay, thank you.